This is the Inform Podcast, episode number 040, episode 40. And Jared and I are really lucky today to be joined by our guest, Dr. Leon Brenner. He is going to be talking to us about a subject that I think is extremely important for people who are interested in psychoanalysis to know about, and that is the way that autism can be engaged with through psychoanalysis, and the way that a clinical practice that is psychoanalytic can work with autistic subjects in a way that is good and effective. Leon, thank you so very much for taking the time to be here with us today. I really appreciate it. I should also mention that you have a book which is coming out, or is it out at this point?
Yeah, it's already published. You can get it online, or you can get the hardcover version.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, so you have a book that is out. And you were kind enough to share some of that book with Jared and I beforehand, and we've both been reading that. And I think that the work that you're doing is extremely important and something that I would encourage any of the students that I teach to take a look at. I think what you're doing is great. But I'm going to turn it over to you now. Why don't you talk about yourself, your own kind of background, your experiences, in particular, what drew you to psychoanalysis and how you started to become interested in psychoanalysis as a clinical procedure that you could use to engage autistic subjects.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, let's start the story. Well, like every good love story, my interest in psychoanalysis was completely accidental. It started, I did read Freud as a young child and then started to learn psychology in the university, but psychoanalysis was quite vague. And I'll tell you the truth, actually, I was in the U.S. Visiting, and I forgot to enroll to my degree, so I couldn't actually enroll into courses. When I came back, it was too late, so I only had the courses that people were not so much interested in. And I fell on the course on Lacan, on Jacques Lacan, which is maybe one of the most influential figures that I've at least had the chance to be influenced by. So that was a complete accident. Yeah, and starting to study Lacan with who became my supervisor back home, started to get extremely inspired. And let's say it was an interesting turn from the idea of a clinic which is politically oriented, rooted in Marx. I was very much involved with Alain Badiou as well at the moment. And then it became, okay, well, it's all about Lacan. In the end, the fact that he never leaves you satisfied, I think, is the driving force behind the years of research that I've conducted so far. So this is the love story, and we're still in the happily ever after. So we'll see. Yes, we have a nice child, my book, which was just published right now with Palgrave, and the book called The Autistic Subject on the Threshold of Language, and we can talk about that later about the title. Was also an accident, or was not planned, at least. I'm very fond of podcasts. This is how I, of course, also was acquainted with your excellent podcast. But I'm also, how do you call them, more conventional listener. So I listen to Radiolab, which I'm sure you know. And they have they did an episode on autism. Which was they're really good. And I really loved that episode and was quite mind-boggling. I tried to identify that phenomenon that they were describing, and maybe quite informally and basically we can say that it was just a child that was, in a way, not speaking at all, not communicating with anybody. And through a strange encounter with his father, which was in a way in disguise, covering his face, speaking with a different voice, using a puppet, all of a sudden a line of communication was enabled between the two, which opened up this child to communication and being part of the family. A huge change for a family of this autistic child, which was, you know, you have to deal with the fact that it's so hard to communicate with your child, with the child that you've raised. You know? Mm-hmm. And I was trying to see, well, how do psychologists explain these things? And there is this notion called selective mutism, which is discussed in the literature. But I'll tell you the truth, I didn't find anything interesting. Now I do come from the field of psychology, but I also come from the field of philosophy as well. So I have philosophical training, and I love a good argument. You know, I love a good deep framework that can explain something. So in a way, Occam's razor and me are sort of enemies in a way. And I was looking at all the theories that you can find. And, you know, there's some prevailing theories. I don't know if you've watched the latest Borat movie, Borat 2. Well, anyways, the guy is called Sacha Baron Cohen. Mm-hmm. Now, his uncle, Simon Baron Cohen, is, I think, one of the biggest figures in the world of autism research today. So he's one of the most biggest, most respected autism researcher in the world. And I was looking on some of his theories and his colleagues. And, you know, there are several schools. But one that was sort of really strange for me is a theory. It's called extreme male brain theory of autism. And again, I'm just going to describe it simply. And of course, it's much more intricate and deeper and goes into the physiology of the brain. But basically, if we look at it conceptually, it states that, well, there are certain brains which we can define as masculine. This is that theory, right, that I do not abide by. Yeah, but this is the theory. So just so the listeners don't get confused. So we
you're not endorsing it. You're just describing it.
Exactly. It's important. It's important. Mm-hmm. So there is this idea that some brains are categorizing brains. So they're brains that are very good in categorizing. These brains are defined as male brains. And there are other types of brains which are empathizing brains, which are better at empathy. And these are called feminine brains. People generally are a mix of those. While, according to the theory, males are more prone to categorization and females are more prone to empathy. What this theory says is that autism is in fact a syndrome that originates in a brain that is extremely masculine. Yeah. So this is the theory, and I was like, come on. I mean, what about, I don't know, just, you know, the very early type of feminist thought, you know, feminist theory, the idea of these divisions, the cultural factor. And I was like, okay, no, we have to think about something that's sort of a bit deeper, right? And so I was, of course, going to Lacan to see if I can find something. I have this huge file, and I can search in all of Lacan's texts in French. So I searched for the word autism. I found it, but that wasn't very promising, sort of more about autoerotism. But then I found Lacan actually referring to autism. That was in 1975, and again, on your sides of the ocean. It was in the States, and he made these comments, direct comments about autism. And basically what he says there is, well, we see all these, let's say, linguistic setbacks, or he says that, well, you see that in the language of the psychotic and the autistic, there is something that freezes. Yeah, that's what he says. He talks to the practitioners that raise this question, and he says, well, the fact that you are not able to speak with them, to listen to them in the sense that you want to take care of them, in the way that you want to take care of them as a therapist, the way you're used to taking care of your therapist, this does not mean that they are out of language, right? They are subjects of language. They are quite verbose. This is what he says in a direct translation. That got me, that hooked me up. I was like, okay. And I started reading texts, and you only find them in French, unfortunately. And this is why I was like really working hard to get this book out, so we'll have some things in English. Yeah. And from these writers, I can mention Jean-Claude Maleval, who's an excellent writer, and he also wrote the foreword to the book. And he has this really terrific book called L'Autiste et sa voix, which is the autist and his voice. And there are also two pioneering thinkers in the Lacanian field, Rosine and Robert Lefort, which, well, started this whole trend. And I started digging deep into that, and it's so rich, it's so interesting. And, you know, my book is just one perspective, one tiny prism into this world. And yeah, and the idea was to sort of demonstrate to the English-speaking academic world and the English-speaking, let's say, clinical world, that psychoanalysis has something very interesting to say about autism, something that can have a deep effect on the way that we relate to autistic people inside and outside of the clinic, right?
Yeah. When I was looking at your book, there's a thought that came to my mind that I wanted to run it by you just to kind of see what this does for you, if this sounds right to you or if it sounds maybe not right. Yeah. Psychoanalysis, you know, is a praxis, mm-hmm. can actually treat autistic subjects as subjects, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that this is that term, that signifier, subject, this is very important. You know, as you pointed out, you're saying that the person who is labeled as autistic is a subject of language. I am a subject of language. You are a subject of language. Jared is a subject of language. We all have this in common. We can all sort of connect through that, I think, and communicate because of it in different ways. And I think there's a propensity in a lot of clinical thought to, whether they would say it this way or not, to see somebody who's labeled as autistic as outside of language, as not a subject of language, and therefore very other than us, different than us, in a way that makes them almost more of like a clinical object, you know, upon which we will perform operations. And that's different than treating them as a subject. Fundamentally different, I would say. So I was curious what you would think about that idea.
Exactly. That's very precise. And yeah, I do engage with that question directly in the book, in the first chapter of the book. We should start from autistic people themselves, you know, and then we get to psychoanalysis, because you were very much exact in why psychoanalysis is so crucial for the facilitation and treatment of autism today, because autistic people are engaged with as subjects. And this is a completely contrary perspective to the most common ways that autism is treated today using ABA treatment. So this applied behavioral analysis, which is a behavioral approach. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, it's we've all learned about conditioning and its power, and it mostly works on that. It's exactly like you said. They're saying, well, we can't talk to them, we can't reason with them, so we'll just condition them to behave in a way that will be useful to them. Again, I'm not saying there's sort of a malevolent factor. There's no evil in it. I think behavioral practitioners are very compassionate people. I'm not saying anything about that in general. I'm just saying that what they give up on is on creating a connection. Exactly. They sort of give up on that because language doesn't function in a way that they themselves can perceive this connection. This is exactly what Lacan says in 1975. But yeah, let's start with autistic people, because I think it's so crucial to listen to them, you know, because there's so many autistic people that speak a lot. They write books, They write internet websites. They have blogs. It's easy. It's easy. You can talk to them. They're really nice. I've talked to many, many autistic people during this research, and I still do. And I'm still surprised by this amazing, colorful world that they present to me whenever I ask them questions, and they're kind enough to answer them.
Yeah, but there's an autistic patient that I've worked with that very frequently would show me the Instagram account that he created, which had so much. He was very interested in trains, and he would talk a lot about trains, right?
Yeah.
And I remember his this is funny, like his parents were like, we want him to not talk about trains. And I was like, no, you actually do want him to talk about trains. I understand that it can be somewhat frustrating because you would also like him to talk about other things, but we're going to start where he's talking. He's talking about this, and it isn't about preventing that, you know, but using that in a way, which I'm sure is where I think you're going with this anyways. It's about using the speech that is produced.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And this is the crucial difference between psychoanalysis and behavioral therapy again, because, you know, sometimes in psychoanalysis, we also say to the analyst or the patient, we say, well, the way that you use this word right now is very productive in this field. Maybe you can generalize it. Okay, of course, you say it a bit differently. But sometimes you do say that, especially when you work with psychotic subjects and autistic subjects. And this is something that you see in ABA. They try to find behaviors and generalize them. But the crucial difference is that in the behavioral perspective, the behaviors are already known to the practitioner. He comes to the clinic knowing which behaviors are to be preserved, generalized, etc. While in psychoanalysis, we collect these inventions and we respect these inventions that come from the subject. And, you know, maybe it's a special interest in trains, and we take that, we harness that, we try and see how a satisfaction can be created out of it, and maybe create a certain curiosity in other fields or in relation to language, etc. So we work with what the patient brings us. And this is quite different, although we do support that and generalize that as well in the clinic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll get there. I think we should definitely talk about that when we get to clinical interventions, when we get to that subject later. But just about the discourse itself, as you've mentioned, you know, there's this scientific discourse, and it has its powers, but also its blind spots. And I think the major blind spot of scientific discourse, at least in the field of mental health, it's called, is the subject, right? It's sort of invisible there. We have a scientific object. And in a way, when scientists ask themselves, well, what is autism? What is the essence of autism, or what is it? They see it as a certain object that can be determined using scientific terms, dealt with, and in a way also cured or eradicated in a way, right? While when you talk to autistic people themselves, they say things quite differently. They say, well, autism is who I am. Autism colors every aspect of my existence. If you take the autism away from me, you're left with somebody that's completely different. That's not me. Right? So you have these people, that's particular people saying that, but this has grew into a huge movement that I'm sure you've heard of so far. It's called the neurodiversity movement. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that movement is sort of, they adopt the neurological discourse, which it helps them today because it's a strong one, right, in the field of science. But what they sort of push is a normative perspective rather than a realist perspective or a scientific perspective. So rather than saying autism is an object, is a real object in the world that we can identify and sort of get rid of, they're more engaged with the normative aspect. How should we address autism? How should autistic people be incorporated in society? What do we think about a cure for autism, right? And from that point of view, I think my perspective on autism grew. Sort of on the one hand, adopting this normative perspective, saying that autism is something that colors every aspect in one's existence and reality. I call it a mode of being in my book. It's a mode of being, right? But on the other hand, I don't neglect completely the scientific approach in the sense that I do try and describe what autism is in these, let's say, maybe structural linguistic or functionalist terms, right? So I sort of adopt these two views and try to reconcile them through psychoanalysis.
Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting as you're saying that. A thought that I have is starting from the point where you said, you know, you don't think that behaviorism is evil, you know, and I would agree with that, right? Like there's things that can be gained through, you know, conditioning and reinforcements and whatnot. Sure. But what I think, and I don't know if I can actually say this in the way that that makes sense outside of my brain, but I'm going to try. I think that what psychoanalysis does is it understands that people get jouissance from things. And autism, in talking about trains, or if in the example that you gave from Radiolab, I remember that child happened to be incredibly taken with Disney films, right?
Yes, exactly.
And engaged with them in this very, very, very deep way. And it was when the father adopted like the voice and the puppet that was a Disney character that he was then able to engage with the kid, because what he did is he tapped into where the jouissance is. And didn't try to say to the person, get rid of your jouissance. Jouissance is bad. We need to have you kill your jouissance and put it away, which is what I think happens in a number of kinds of therapeutic interventions, right? Which I'm, like you said, we'll get to those later, where that's the idea here. It is a parallel. I think a lot of times therapists will say to somebody who has a substance abuse issue, stop drinking. Okay,
yes.
Sure. But there's what you're not understanding is the jouissance that's there in the drinking, and that jouissance actually is perhaps a stabilizing factor in that person's existence. To give that up would be giving up their being in the world, not something that they have. You know, we can give up things that we have. Giving up something that we are. This is not possible. And this is a key insight, I think, that your work is pointing out in regards to the psychoanalytic treatment of individuals who we call autistic, that there's a jouissance here in what they're doing and how they're living. And it is not something like we can just like remove that the same way that we couldn't remove, you know, subjectivity from anybody.
Yes, I agree. I would just... The concept of jouissance is such a loaded one, yeah. And we have to remember that, well, jouissance is what goes beyond the pleasure principle. So when we talk about a certain pleasure, and in a special interest there is a pleasure, yeah. Sometimes in our behavior, in our repetitive behavior, in our symptomatic behavior, we also have this special kind of pleasure, which also entails a suffering, right? What I would definitely say, there is a unique type of suffering, which is autistic, yeah? But I think what is to be respected, and this has to do with the subject, is more what psychoanalysis is all about, the unconscious, right? Because, well, like you said, if I go to somebody and he tells me, okay, stop drinking, yeah, great. Or, you know, I read a self-help book and it says, well, you should, I don't know, find a girlfriend, get married, and have kids. I'm like, okay, but usually our suffering is not a matter that we can sort of consciously wrap our minds around and solve it. Right? You go to a coach if you want to do that. You go to a psychoanalyst if you believe that there is some part in you which you have no idea of, but still has a major hold of your behavior and your feelings and your enjoyment and your pleasure in life, right? So we go and we look on that direction, and you know, Lacan says the subject of the unconscious. This is one way Lacan refers to the subject, because there is something that speaks through me. There is something that speaks in my body. There's something that speaks in my words, which I do not consciously control or have access to, right? So in the clinic, we sort of try and put our emphasis on the unconscious, right? And I think this is a huge difference that sort of we can distinguish psychoanalysis by being, we're people that believe that there is an unconscious. I think this is how you start an analysis.
Hmm? Yeah. Hmm? And the unconscious has effects.
Yeah, exactly. And the unconscious has effects. Exactly. So when we look at the subject as the subject of the unconscious, and again, I was saying this term modes of being, right? Or mode of being. I called autism a mode of being. The idea is that there are sort of different ways in which symptoms manifest. We can say different ways in which consciousness and the unconscious interact. I'm saying the same thing again. There are different ways in which language is entangled with the body. There are different ways in which jouissance manifests. But I'm saying just the same thing. And, you know, what Freud tried to do is he was saying, well, I'm seeing all these patients. Of course, they're all singular. They're all particular. Everyone has their unique suffering. But, you know, he was trying to say, well, I need some guidelines sort of to know how to deal with some types and some other types. And he was trying to see if there are types, you know, if there are actually more general types. And he had this list, you know, and the first one is neurosis that we know about. And Freud also talked about perversion and psychosis. So at his time, and even up to today, psychoanalysts are sort of, if we say, meeting these subjects at the clinic, which can be diagnosed or distributed into these groups, right? And this sort of means the way reality unravels, or a mode of being, like I say. So these are the three general modes of being that psychoanalysis talks about. The general argument in my book is that autism cannot be reduced to any of them. And in this sense, we have to speak of autism as a unique, singular mode of being. And, well, this is also a message, well, for the world, of course, but also for psychoanalysts, that we can no longer address autism in terms of psychosis, which was traditionally done, or through any other conceptual framework which relates to neurosis, perversion, or psychosis.
Right? Yeah, so that's interesting. So I wanted to ask you a bit about this. So when I was reading the book, one of the things that it was clear that you were saying that, okay, there's kind of like these, generally speaking, distinct ways that we can see that people kind of are in the world, the way that they relate to everything around them. It's sort of like through a particular lens, a lens of neurosis, a lens of psychosis. And you're adding to that, and this is what was so interesting to me, a lens of autism. Now, I think that there's been in various like sorts of strains of thought an idea that, you know, how there's sort of two subtypes of neurotics. You have hysterics and you have obsessives. Mm-hmm. And they have different forms of desire. The hysterics' desire is never going to be satisfied, and the obsessive's desire is impossible. And what you were saying here is not that autism is like some sort of subset of psychosis, the way that hysteria and obsession is a subset of neurosis, but that it is a separate way of being in the world, its own structural category, actually. Exactly. And I thought that was fascinating. And I was wondering if you could maybe speak about why you see it as a separate structure, as opposed to a structure which could be kind of like contained within the structure of psychosis.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. I'll mention that I have very good friends in Belgium, which think otherwise. They think that autism is a form of psychosis, and they have interesting arguments that should be seriously engaged with, right? I just happen to think otherwise, that we should take autism outside of this axis of psychosis. And this is the point of the book. Now, what for something that we sort of first have to wrap our minds around is the notion that, well, at least I believe that in Freud psychoanalysis, there is no coherent category of the normal or the healthy, right? There is no place outside of neurosis, perversion, and psychosis. Yeah, there is no world which is without repression, disavowal, or foreclosure. And in this sense, there is no healthy, normal subject, right? There's only different ways through which the world is a little, the world sucks a little bit, or doesn't work a little bit, or, you know, this is how it is. I know it's horrible because you get out of analysis with this in your mind and in your heart, but it's actually a good place to be. It's fine. You don't have to be happy. It's fine. Yeah, mm-hmm. This is something that you should sort of fathom. Nevertheless, you know, when you meet a psychotic person, you see that their suffering is much more accentuated. Yeah, so this is something that we shouldn't neglect to mention. Of course, it's more accentuated in psychosis, especially when psychosis is triggered. Mm. Now, when Freud tried to differentiate between these modes, let's say, what he called mental structures, what Lacan calls subjective structures, you know, he said, well, there are two ways we can differentiate them. The first one is what you see today in psychiatry, which is the apparent behaviors. So, you know, you go to DSM, you have these behaviors. You can list them and you can diagnose. You can sort of write down what you see, what manifests in behavior, in thought, in report, etc. And let's say in psychosis, you, after a triggering, you a lot of times you have hallucinations. They might be vocal, visual. There are delusional formations a lot of times. Sometimes there is a paranoia. You know, so these things are sort of, you meet a person which behaves in this way, and this way you can sort of say, okay, I can distinguish this as a psychosis, right? And yeah, if you go to a psychiatrist and you say, well, I've been hallucinating for the past few months, and speaking with God or something like that, you probably get a diagnosis. Yeah. So this is how it goes. And Freud said, well, this is one way to do that. But then he also mentions that this can be quite confusing. And I think that from my experience, that's very true. Because there are people that hallucinate from time to time, but are not psychotic. Yeah. The fact that you hallucinate does not mean that you are psychotic. There are delusional people with some ideas, some delusional ideas that are, you know, I would say, okay, that's pretty strange. But, you know, they're not necessarily psychotic. So these behaviors, they're not necessarily entail a diagnosis of a psychosis. Now, what Freud specifically talked about is in his paper on Schreber, that he writes about psychosis, he talks about this withdrawal from the world. Right? He says, well, in psychosis, we see a complete withdrawal from the world. It's called in psychoanalytic terms a decathaxis. So the energy is disinvested. The person sinks into out of the world. And then he says, well, we see that in neurosis as well sometimes. Yeah. And then he says, well, he gives some examples, and he says, well, we cannot focus on this secondary aspect of the syndrome, let's say how the symptoms manifest visibly, how we see them, they're very apparent. He said, well, in order to differentiate them, we have to go back to the psychic mechanism that sets it all in place. No. Now you know that psychoanalysts, they say when you're young something happens, and from that day on you're sort of set in a way. Yeah, you're fixated even, right? And this is the idea that Freud progressed, right? In order to differentiate these these structures, these mental structures, he went to these mechanisms that fixate. And in the case of neurosis, there's something that's called repression. Yeah? And again, in my book, I go a little deeper because for Freud, there is a repression, which is defense, in the sense of, well, I have this idea, it's too distressing. Again, very simply. And what happens is it is repressed, so it is disconnected from the affect, the distressing affect that was attached to it, and inscribed in the unconscious, sort of never enters consciousness in this attached form. So this is repression as defense. But Freud also talked about a primal repression, which is more constitutive in nature. Yeah? And he was sort of saying, well, if the mind, if repression as defense functions, and sort of there's an idea and then it's inscribed in the unconscious, and then there's something that is inscribed in consciousness, he said, in order for this mechanism to function, we have to have this division set in the psyche in the first place. You know, it's sort of like, it's the mailman. He says, okay, this goes here, this goes there. But in order for the mailman to function, we'll have to have him have these, like, I don't know, these tubes where he can throw the mails. Yeah. So he said primal repression is what splits the psyche and sort of creates this structure that we call neurosis. Yeah. So, yeah, if you want to comment, we can.
No, I was just going to say, like, that's one of the things that's really cool about the book that you've written here, too. And yeah. You know, I teach about this stuff in a graduate school pretty regularly. And the way that you, in a text on autism, engage with the idea of psychic structures or subjective structures is really great because it explains them in a way that does make sense, right? So it's useful, I would say, for anybody who's interested in getting a firmer grasp on that idea, you know, about how it is repression that causes neurosis, not the other way around, right?
Exactly.
You're not neurotic and therefore you repress and therefore you are neurotic. And it isn't psychosis that creates foreclosure, but foreclosure that creates psychosis.
Absolutely.
You do a great job of, I think, explaining that in a way which is very, very readable, which is an incredible thing when writing about Lacan, right? You know, because Lacan himself, sometimes I'll go to events and people will say, Lacan clearly stated whatever. And I'm like, when did Lacan clearly state anything? He didn't. You know, we can extrapolate things from what he said and render it in a clear way. And I think that's kind of part of what you're doing here. And I think that that's what makes the work very valuable. And one of the things that makes it valuable is that you're able to do that. You're able to do that. And as I was reading it, I was finding myself, like, you know, kind of highlighting different bits because I'm like, this is really good because this is, again, it's a way to really kind of hammer down the point that repression is the thing that creates the neurotic subject and that foreclosure is the thing that creates the psychotic subject. And if people can, I think, understand that, that will make a huge difference in the way that they conceptualize the cases that they're working with, right?
Yes.
Because I think a lot of times people come at it the opposite way. And this creates, I mean, you can do that. People do. But I don't think it's nearly as effective from a clinical perspective. I think it's much more effective to start with this idea that you're treating the repression, you're treating the foreclosure, as opposed to treating the neurosis or treating the psychosis.
Yes, exactly. And it also entails accepting this form of structuration. So we're not going to cure someone of his or her neurosis. This is not our goal. We'll try to find a way for this person to, I don't know, be enthusiastic about life or choose to enjoy it and invest his energy in something, but not to make him or her not neurotic.
And as you talked about, I think too, that also applies to psychosis and autism. We're not going to cure an autistic subject. They're not going to come in and, as a result of our, you know, clinical jujitsu, be cured of their autism. And this applies to other things. If somebody's schizophrenic or some other form of triggered psychosis, they're not going to be cured. If somebody is an untriggered or ordinary psychosis, the same thing. They're not going to be cured of this. That's not the point of psychoanalytic treatment, is to cure. I suppose yes. We could say to change the manner in which a person understands and relates to this thing, which is a constitutional part of who they are in the world.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, we talked about autism, and autistic people, they say it out loud. They say, well, you take the autism out of your child, you're left without your child. You're left with someone else. This is a guy, this inspirational speaker called Jim Sinclair. He says that many times. But also in psychosis, you are absolutely right. I'm not saying that medication should not be used. Again, like not saying that behavioral therapy is evil. It's sometimes very important. But what you clearly see when a psychotic person takes medication is that their internal world disappears. And what we work with in analysis is the ideas that come up to the mind. Are these unique and special notions of the world? And we work with them. Yeah, and when a psychotic takes medicine, we're left without much to work with as analysts, right? And you've mentioned the fact that a person can be structured as psychotic, sort of foreclosure did take place, but is not triggered. And you correctly called this ordinary psychosis, which is a term that Jacques Alain Miller sort of coined at a certain point, which is a person which is psychotic, structurally psychotic, but, you know, lives pretty good life. Mm. I live in Berlin. It's an excellent city for psychotics. it's very easy to be a psychotic here and not suffer so much, you know. And this, I think this, so here we see also the social element entering the scene. And we see that it's not, oh, you're psychotic, we need to cure you. Right, exactly.
You know, you're invoking Berlin. I don't know if this is correct. I never met the person who I'm about to refer to. But David Bowie, in particular during his Berlin period, is somebody who I sometimes use as a plausible, you know, example of an ordinary psychotic. And I like that example because I mean, you can see that he was an incredibly successful artist. And I think that part of the reason that he was a successful artist was because he was able to be psychotic in that way. He found a way to make it work for him. And here we go, right? Like if you were to take away Bowie's psychosis, you know, what would you be left with? It wouldn't be David Bowie.
Right. 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 And this is something that autistic people say explicitly. If you cure autism, what about all this talent? What about the diversity that autistic people bring to humanity? We're going to lose all of that. So, yeah, absolutely. We're very much aware of that when we talk about the normative aspect of autism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I know that this seems like maybe a good point, too. And if this isn't a good point, just tell me it's not, you know, or there's other things you want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But you know, Jared, you had asked a question kind of in our pregame here about intervention. I think maybe this would be a good time for you to jump in with that question.
Yeah, I mean, I was just curious about how you think about interventions when you're working with people that have autism. I think probably in psychoanalysis, the dominant way of thinking about autism is as a like you can collapse it under psychosis. So that leads you to one set of interventions, but you think of it as a different clinical structure altogether outside of neurosis, perversion, psychosis. So I'm wondering how that changes the way that you think about interventions and then what those interventions look like sort of, you know, generally. Obviously, I'm not going to ask you for like specific exact, that's not how it really works, but just the way that you think about them, I'm interested to hear about.
Yeah, well, we can talk about this for like the next 3 hours, but let's say basically, you know, interventions are in psychoanalysis are interventions in language, mm-hmm. right? I have friends that do body therapy, and it's a different kind of intervention, right? It's sort of at least oriented or sort of facing a different direction. That's how it seems. But the interventions in psychoanalysis are interventions in language. Right? Nevertheless, in an analysis or in a treatment, that's a more better way, that's a better way to call it, the treatment of autism, you don't ask questions about dreams and fantasies and you don't interrogate the unconscious in this specific way. You don't do these things. Mm-hmm. A better way to call the involvement of the analyst is, like you said, an intervention and not an interpretation. Mm-hmm. You know? Now, this is, if we really want to explain them, because I can go into the different types of interventions that I sort of present in the book and sort of recommend on developing. But we have to first go to the basics. Like, why do we do these kinds of interventions? Mm-hmm. So when we look at the subject in psychoanalysis, like I said earlier, there's Lacan says that this, there's a certain intertwining between language and the body. So something about language sets the reality of the body, the way the body is, the way the body is situated in the world, the way the body is experienced, it sets it in place, right? And provides us with much more, with an identity, a culture, society, art, politics, science, etc. Now, maybe like quite basically, because I go deeply into this in the book, but we can describe the different subjective structures as different forms or different modes through which language is intertwined with the body, or different modes through which the subject gains access to language and uses language in the construction and formation of reality. Right? Now, Lacan talks about signifiers. He's very much involved with a field that's called semiotics. It was a modern form of linguistics in the previous century, not modern anymore, but it was very groundbreaking at the time. And what he says is that in primal repression, we were talking about that, there's a certain organizing element instated in the subject's mode of access to language, which creates a certain order which is familiar to us, and please let me just assume neurotic subjects, okay? So for us neurotics, the world makes sense in a certain way. Neil talked to me a little bit about that earlier. It's called the name of the father, the signifier of the name of the father in Lacan, which has many meanings, but basically it is a very special kind of linguistic unit that creates a specific order in language and makes it function in a specific way. What is this way? It functions on the basis of signifiers, right? Now, what is a signifier? Again, we can talk about this simply. We don't need to really delve into the intricate linguistic theory. Signifier is a linguistic unit, not so much a word. It's not a whole word. The linguist that Lacan refers to a lot is Ferdinand de Saussure. And for him, the signifier is a sound image. It's a little bit of sound, like ah, e, u, okay? And when we take different signifiers and we pose them next to each other but oppose them one to another, so ah is opposed to e, and then e is opposed to la, okay? So we oppose the signifiers. We create this sort of network of oppositions. At a certain point, signification happens. We say the word zebra. Yeah, and then, well, that means something and we can talk about it, and Jared and me can have a discussion about zebras, because these signifiers, they created meaning. This is how they interacted. Now, what is important to know is that signifiers by themselves are empty. They have no meaning. They're just bits of sound. They don't mean anything. And even this word zebra, when we have it, it's not that it refers to a specific zebra in the world, that I can go to the safari and see this zebra. It is a concept. It is a linguistic concept, something that is reserved to that domain, right? And this is how language operates for us. We don't think about things and have a referent in the world, right? This is why we can have general concepts. This is why we can have abstract concepts. This is why we can talk about infinity. Show me infinity. Yeah, let's see it somewhere outside there. We can have a discussion about it because our linguistic mode of access to language is based on signifiers, and this is how they create meaning.
We can talk about time travel, even though no one can time travel.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. We can do a lot of interesting, great things. This is, you know, people say it's boring to be just sane or neurotic. You know, it's, there's a lot of people exploring the edge of consciousness, etc. But you know what? There are other modes of access to language. You can experience them. Nevertheless, this mode that we share, it has a lot of good things about it. You know, we can work with it. You know, so this is sort of like us neurotics working with our understanding of the world. Now, this is dependent on the name of the father. And again, without getting too much into Lacanian theory, we can if you want, but you'll have to force me to do it. Yeah. But for the neurotic, there is an instatement of the name of the father, and language is organized in this way. So a signifier create meaning in this way. In psychosis, there is what is called a foreclosure. And, you know, it's interesting because I always say, well, after reading Lacan, you can read Freud for the second time as though you read him for the first time, right? And when Freud talks about psychosis, he says, at a certain paper, he says, well, foreclosure is actually based on a failed repression. Yeah? So there's a repression, it fails, and then foreclosure happens. And it's sort of like a bit hard to wrap your mind around it when you're left only with that text. But after reading Lacan and after sort of getting acquainted with the theory of the name of the father, you see that there is a primal repression. There is an statement of the signifier of the name of the father. And then there is a foreclosure. What's foreclosure? An eradication. Okay, let's say repression is taking a signifier or an idea in Freudian terms and inscribing it in the unconscious. It's still there in the psyche, right? A foreclosure is a complete eradication, right? So what you see in psychosis, and when you talk about psychosis, there is a structuring element and a triggering element, right? So the structuring element in psychosis is the foreclosure of the name of the father. What happens then? Well, language doesn't operate in the same way. Yeah, it operates differently. Yeah.
One of the ways I sometimes try to explain this to people, and I don't know if this works or not. Like I don't know if I quite have it. I say like with a neurotic, you have an image, and you kind of like have somebody in the picture. You don't want them there, like your ex-girlfriend or something. I don't know. And so you kind of like cover her over with something that technically still there. Just kind of covered over in a way, where I think in psychosis you'd actually like take scissors and you'd cut out this person altogether, and now would be this big hole where that person used to be in the image itself, right? You know, and I said it's a way of thinking about, I think, the difference between these two things.
Yeah, and I think a hole is a great way to call it. That's how Lacan calls it, a hole. There is a hole in the place where the name of the father stood.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the name of the father had this organizing capacity, it had sort of made language to be the authority that sort of creates order in the world. Without the name of the father, the world is not as orderly. Mm-hmm. And this is a psychosis, and this is how it is structured.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. You know, a question for you here. Like I one of the things that I noticed too about this from a clinical perspective is that this is gonna be hard to describe. Bear with me for a second here. So I've worked with a lot of teenagers in my clinical practice. And one of the things that will happen sometimes, I'll have a neurotic teenager, and what they'll want to do is they'll want to convince me that they're psychotic, or they'll want to convince the world perhaps and me as well that they are psychotic for a variety of different reasons, you know, usually because they think that makes them interesting, or because they think that will excuse some sort of thing that they've done. And they, so they kind of try to act as if they have foreclosed, but they haven't. You can tell, you can sense it. And the way that I think about this now is that when I speak with somebody who is psychotic, that's not something you can fake, right? Like, because as I think you're saying, Leon, it's something that the person is, right? This isn't an act. This isn't a performance. This isn't an affectation that they're putting on in an attempt to get something that they want. It is the way that they are in the world. And that is not something that I think people can very effective, maybe a very skilled actor could convince me, but the teenagers I'm working with are not skilled actors. But you know, it's really hard to do that, because I've also worked with psychotic individuals. Uh-huh. And when you work with a psychotic individual, there's no mistaking it, right? You know, there's something not there. There's something missing in this person. And the fact that it's missing is influencing the way that they talk, the way that they think, exactly, the way that they experience everything they experience. Mm-hmm. And there's no faking that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. The first place to look at is in speech. Because, you know, they say, well, you have the psychotic hallucinating that he saw God yesterday, but there are neurotics going to church that they hallucinate that God spoke to them, mm-hmm, right? We don't think that every religious person that experiences this is psychotic. But there is a difference in the way that they convey it, because the neurotic would say, well, God spoke to me yesterday, but what does he want? What does he want from me? Am I the next Messiah? And the psychotic would say, well, God spoke to me, and I am the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a mode of certainty that is embedded in the way that language is used by psychotics, which you can identify. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, we're less interested about the hallucination itself, but about the way that language enables the hallucination to manifest in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. It's a hallucination, which is sort of like inbounds versus out, I suppose, kind of comes to mind when you say that. And this is what's interesting to me, too, is, again, to kind of come back to this idea of interventions. Like, mm-hmm, you can intervene with a neurotic who has what I would call a psychotic episode, but not a psychotic structure, mm-hmm, because you can still work with them within the structure of language, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a way to do that. When you're talking with somebody who's psychotic, you can't use, I don't think, a neurotic level intervention and expect the same results. You're going to get something totally different. This is where
it's very,
go ahead.
It's very important not to treat a psychotic in the same way to treat a neurotic. It's very, very important. Absolutely. Yeah.
How would you that's where I'm interested about the interventions with autistic individuals. Like,
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, we I think all here today talking understand that you wouldn't treat a psychotic and a neurotic in the same fashion. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to bet that a majority of our listeners will easily agree to that. Mm-hmm. What do you think is, like, looking at this, there's a way you can treat a neurotic, there's a way you can treat a psychotic. Mm-hmm. Is the way that you treat in your framework, you know, a person with autism, with that autistic way of being in the world, how does the style of treatment, the style of intervention, maybe differ from, say, like the treatment of a neurotic or a psychotic?
So Neil, yeah, I always take the long road in order to get to the point. Yeah, this is what we're doing. We're taking the long road to talking about interventions, because, like you said, interventions have something to do with language. Yeah? And with neurotics, we intervene on the level of the signifier. Yes. And with psychotics, even though there is a foreclosure and there is no name of the father, there is still a symbolic order that can be worked with. The symbolic order is the place of signifiers, right? So interventions in psychosis are also interventions that take the function of signifiers and harnesses them in the treatment of a psychosis, right? So it is different, yeah, because it's a different mode of operation with signifiers, but still it is work with signifiers.
Right, right.
Now, yeah. Now, what is the problem with autism for practitioners is that it seems that, well, autistic people don't have access to language, or, you know, this is the some notion of it. In the Lacanian clinic, what is commonly said is that in autism, there is no big other. This is something that you find already in the 80s in Rosine and Robert Lefort. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It's strange because Lacan says in psychosis, there is still another. There is still a symbolic order, right? Of course, there is a hole in the symbolic and it functions differently, but there is still a symbolic order. And what many psychoanalysts say about autism is that in autism, there is no symbolic order. Right? Now, what I sort of transformed this or sort of developed this is to the notion that this there is no other. It does not mean that autistic subjects are out of language. It means that their mode of access to language doesn't go through the signifier. And this is already quite, this is already like new stuff. You know, this is like new stuff in the Lacanian field. This is sort of like going a few steps forward than what we're used to seeing in Lacan. Yeah. Now, what I develop is this idea, and again, I develop it with Jean-Claude Malleval. But I take a little more, how would you say, a stronger stand on it. Yeah. What I generally argue is that, yes, the foreclosure in the basis of autism, I call it autistic foreclosure, yeah? And also in the book, I really go into a lot of detail in order to distinguish it from the psychotic foreclosure and situate it on a different level. I talk about the psychic object that is foreclosed, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a huge part of the book, but we're going to intervention, so we'll leave that behind maybe for a later interview. What I generally argue is that while autistic people or autistic subjects don't have access to the level of the signifier, they do have access to a different kind of linguistic unit that Lacan calls the sign. Now, the sign comes from semiotics as well, and especially from this linguist called Jacobson. And what a sign is an element, a linguistic unit, that has a referent, one referent, and this is how it conveys meaning. There are some examples. Let's say smoke is the sign of fire, or the portrait of Abraham Lincoln is a sign that this is Abraham Lincoln that we're talking about. What is unique about a sign is that a sign is tied, is closely tied to its referent, to its signified. Whereas signifiers, they are empty. They don't have a referent. They only refer to each other. And by referring to each other, they create signification. Now, what I argue is that autistic people, while they do not have the big other in the sense of the symbolic big other, in the sense of the signifier, they do have access to language if they harness the power of linguistic signs, right? Now, this explains a lot about autistic phenomenology and experience. Let's say the rigidity of the language, the fact that autistic children use the definite article when talking about thing, about general concepts. It's the TV, and there is one TV. And if you want to convince an autistic child that the other TV at grandma's is also a TV, you'll need to do some hard work, right? Children that are, let's say, neurotic, perverse, or psychotic, they are prone to this sort of fluidity in generalizing what they learn. They learn, okay, this is a bird, but then they also call a bee a bird. Yeah, because and then you have to tell them, no, this is not a bird. A bee has wings, but it's smaller, and etc. For autistic, it's the exact opposite, right? One sign has one meaning. So, for instance, if an autistic child sees a cat on a sunny day, and he says, "This is a cat," and he knows this is a cat, and when he sees this cat, he knows it's a cat. But if he's, like, theoretically, if he will see the same cat on a rainy day, he will not know that this is a cat. You will have to sort of teach him in a way that that is the same as this, and this won't make a lot of sense. It's not sort of immediately fathomed like people that use signifiers are used to, right? So my general notion about interventions in autism is that what we need to do is we need to use this linguistic capacity in order to progress the child between several, let's say, points or levels of linguistic functionality, yeah, that brings him in the end to a point where he has much more satisfaction and freedom in life.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. I think that's really great. I mean, because what you're getting at is, and it's something that's so easy to take for granted when you're neurotic, is that we communicate at the level of the signifier, which allows for an enormous amount of ambiguity and flexibility in how we communicate, right? We can say, I'm fine, and that can mean anything because of exactly. the flexibility of the signifier. Where and if I'm following what you're saying correctly, you know, we treat neurotics along that line. We play a language game. We engage them that way. When you're treating somebody with autism, everything is a sign. Everything.
Yes.
Is a sign. There's no signifier. So you have to be, and that's not the way, you know, that I think. It's not the way that I think most people think, right? But it is the way that a person who is autistic does think. Everything is yeah. a sign. It is singular. Everything is singular.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Everything, every linguistic element is singular. And imagine how difficult it is to construct a language which you can use. How difficult it is to communicate with people that they will tell you, I'm fine. Or they will tell you, I'm fine. Or mm-hmm. they will tell you, I'm fine. Or they're on the stage and they say, I'm fine. Or they say to their mother asking, how are you? They say, I'm fine. But we can sort of get it through the context, you know, it's like, oh, the color of the voice actually says that he's not fine. Mm-hmm. Or we know, oh, he's lying to his mother because he doesn't want to tell her how he feels, et cetera, et cetera. So we have all the capacity to take these signifiers and know that they are contextual. They are determined in their relations to other pieces of meaning in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But for an autistic person, I'm fine means I'm fine. And if you tell him I'm fine in a higher pitch, he would just like, okay, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very common thing that you see also with people that are diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome,
mm-hmm.
which psychologists call this like a very functional form of autism. There's still these problems with communication and social interactions, which to my view are based on the fact that autistic language is based on signs and not on signifiers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So how do we use that in intervention? This is what I call the autistic linguistic spectrum. This is the seventh chapter of the book. And I sort of develop a framework that I saw in Maleval's work. And I sort of give a take on it. And this is something that we call in psychoanalysis, and this is, again, rooted in the very early psychoanalysis of autism, like psychoanalysts like Margit Mahler and Franz Tustin, and the idea that in Lacanian psychoanalysis we call the rim, bord in French. The rim is translated to the rim in English. This is how I thought of translating it. The idea is that, and you were speaking about jouissance when we started this talk, the idea is that language is a way to handle jouissance, to handle the body, to handle reality. And children learn how to do that from their parents their parents that teach them how to use signifiers in order to explain, oh, your tummy hurts, or oh, you're hungry, or it's okay that you hit your head, or stuff like that. So these are just general examples of how language is used in order to deal with these invasions of excitation, sometimes painful, sometimes pleasurable. But we use language in order to take that thing which is too much in definition and make it into something which is fathomable. It is part of my reality. Repression is a way. When something is too much, we repress. Yeah? But if you don't have signifiers, what do you do? So in what I call this autistic linguistic spectrum, I describe four different levels on which the rim is constructed using signs. Right? Now, the first level, which is, let's say, the most severe form of autism, which we can see maybe in very young children or very, very severe cases. And we also see we see that described in the literature a lot. Like I said, Franz Tustin worked with autistic people that experienced that. Also Donald Meltzer. But what we see on this level is that there is no rim which separates the subject from these brutal invasions of jouissance. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It is what some autistic people even call a pure presence of death. Yeah? But we would say it is the death drive which is present. Mm-hmm. Yeah? The body and, you know, the working of the body and the world and these the things that we perceive and the stimuli, it just constantly invades the subject with no form of mediation, no form of protection. And this is a mode of extreme anxiety where we see children committing extreme acts of violence, self-aggressiveness, self-mutilation. They scratch themselves, they bite, they hit their head on the wall. All of that is done in the aim of demarcating some form of a rim for that thing that is experienced as a constant invasion. Okay? Again, I'm getting a bit metaphorical here, but this is just due to the lack of time. Okay, and we'll try and explain this simply today without delving into more intricate theory. Now, the first level of the implementation of the sign is called the protective rim. This is a construction that protects the subject from this invasion, but that's about it. Okay, we heard some analysts talking about it as the autistic shell. Bruno Bettelheim called it the empty fortress, sort of somewhere that the person goes to and closes himself off. But what we see in the use of this protective shell is the use of objects. So what we see a lot is autistic children, they take objects and they don't use them for their, let's say, objective purpose. They use them for very strange purposes, which are not so clear, mostly sticking them to their body, using them for their hard sensation, right? So this level is the first level in which language is engaged with on a very, very, very primordial level. The sign is used in marking objects, sort of an object gets a designation by a sign, it gets an existence in the world. And what we see is that autistic people associate these sensations that they have with these specific objects. And this way they make these sensations a bit more predictable and controllable.
This is fascinating to me, right? Like one of the things that comes up in my own work and my own teaching very often is a saying, I say this a bunch, the body is a part of you that has a mind of its own. And what I think we understand, you know, as neurotic subjects is yes, and we can get a handle, to use one of your words from earlier, get a handle on it through language, on this body, which sometimes desires that, which maybe like I, the subject, don't. You know, we can do that. We can use language as a tool to sort of like modulate the body as an entity. So when somebody doesn't have access to that, as you're saying, right, there's a different thing that they use to modulate what it is that this overwhelming body that you know wants whatever it wants, and there's no filtration, right? It's just full on experience of bodily desire.
Exactly.
And what I think, if I'm following you correctly, you're talking about is working with these autistic individuals through the sign to develop a variety of different ways that they might be able to modulate the body.
Exactly. Yes. Through the sign and through objects. Mm-hmm. Through the sign and with objects, right? And these objects that are carefully selected by these children, you know, it's not, it can be any object. It has to be specifically related to a specific sensation, a specific problematic that the child needs to deal with. By supporting the adoption of this object and facilitating it, trying to complexify it, trying to repeat it, to show that, yes, by naming this stick, giving it a name, and by calling for it whenever you need it, you can gain a certain mastery over your body, right? You can make the world not so horrific, right? Not so horrible. And this is the first step. So if you're talking about like a one type of intervention, and again, you need to diagnose, you need to say, this autistic subject is on the level of the protective rim. And at this level, we need to facilitate the use of objects in the way that they mediate these bodily sensations. Yeah? Mm. And this is what you work with the child. You don't try to teach the child how to behave with his peers at this point. You work with objects. This would be a clinic that is rich with objects, where the child can freely roam, preferably with other children, because we didn't get to this. We won't get to this today, but there's a certain facilitative aspect to mimicking and copying. So seeing other children, seeing their solutions, being in an environment where you are free to roam and find your own solutions, this would be the first type of intervention that we will see in autism. There's a beautiful movie called A Ciel Ouvert, An Open Sky.
Oh, yeah, the work at Courtiel.
Exactly, which shows the work in Belgium with autistic people, and you'll see that a lot of work that is done like that. Mm. Now, the second, let's say, mode of intervention, or the second clinic that we would say, there's the clinic of the protective rim, and there's the clinic of the dynamic rim. Okay. So what is the dynamic rim? Very, very briefly, if we're talking about these objects, these are quite simple in their capacity on the level of the protective rim, in the sense that they create a rim to the body. Yeah, these objects can be developed, can complexify by using signs, by attaching more signs to them, they can become more complex. Now, what's a complex or dynamic object? It's an object that doesn't have one function. Yeah, that is not just sitting there and I can use it for this single function. It has a multiplicity of functions. Yeah, it can change over time. Yeah, so we can say in a way that the complex autistic object is an object that can be a montage of simple autistic objects that harnesses their different libidinal functions into a more intricate, you can even call this machine, that the child can implement for treating more complicated situations in the world with his body, with other people, etc. Right? Yeah. So when we talk about the dynamic rim, this is the point where we see a sort of transition from a fascination with specific objects and specific functions that the child discovers in them, sort of like accidentally walking around and finding it, to a point where the child starts constructing complex objects that he chooses. He chooses to implement and he chooses to build up together. Now, an excellent example you can find in the book of Bruno Bettelheim, where he talks about Joey the mechanical boy. And it's a child that started collecting different objects in the world. Each object helped him with something else. One helped him go to the toilet. One helped him speak. One helped him do other things. And he composes this machine, which he carries around. And through it, he animates himself. Right? So what we would see on this level of the dynamic rim is developing these complex objects and in a way supporting the child in transitioning from an interest in just a specific kind of satisfaction that the child gains by using these objects to what is commonly called specific interests or special interests. Mm. This is what you talked about in the beginning, an interest in trains. Right? So by finding a toy train and seeing that this object is not so simple, it has many dynamic functions, the child gains a certain fascination, which can only be elaborated using language, using signs. And this is what we call special interests. These develop of obsessions with specific objects, their capacities. But these are obsessions that are developed in a form of building up a language. Building up a language that has to do with this specific object.
Yeah, that's perfect. I think as you're talking about it, that train example. I mean, the interest in trains led to one of the interventions that was performed was getting the kid a camera, and now the kid could go and take pictures of trains, and with the pictures of trains, he could start to talk more about different things, and then this led to. Yeah, you know, seeing that there was other people also doing this, train spotters, you know, and this then meant that there was, oh, there's other people who are interested in this thing too. And now there's another potential avenue of communication. So it's very interesting to me to think about this because in that instance, doing that, like kind of starting with one sign, a train, you can link that clearly to all of these other signs. And in linking those other signs, what ends up happening, I guess, maybe this is a kind of a crude way to put it, but the autistic kid sees the point in attempting to communicate.
Exactly. Yes. This is the next step, right? This is the next step that is in fact, internal to the dynamic rim. Yeah. So this is the third stage. So when we talk about clinical interventions, we're still on the same clinic. So this would be a clinic where you complexify the object, where you support specific interests, right? And what I argue, and this is a point where Maleval and me are a bit, we differ our thoughts here. There is this concept notion that's called the synthetic other. That I develop in the book. The synthetic other is an other, like the big other, but an other that's composed of signs, not of signifiers. Yeah, it's synthetic because it is built ad hoc using signifiers, and it lacks the more natural or fluid character of the big other that is made of signifiers. But the synthetic other, you can call it, you can say, this is the locus where signs are collected and preserved in all of these inventions that the child creates, the simple objects that he elects in order to create a protective rim, the complex objects that it creates in order to create a dynamic rim. All of these are sort of saved or preserved in the synthetic other. Mm. Now, in order to progress the child, or what kind of intervention do we see after specific interests appear, is an attempt to show the child that language is more curious than he even thinks, right? That language can used not only for this unique kind of satisfaction that he achieves by being invested in trains, but by using language, he can learn about other human beings, or he can learn about the world, or utilizing the same rules and laws that he founds in trains, he can understand something in cars. So he learns that while a sign only has one referent, by developing his treasury of signs, he is able to create a knowledge which surpasses this specific type of interest. It opens him up to many, many possibilities, right? And this is what I differentiate between the closed synthetic other, which is something that we see in autism, which are autistic people, which are quite functional, but they use language more for their own need, for their own gain. They use it for what they need, for their satisfaction. They sometimes compose a private language that only they understand. And they use language up to the extent that they are satisfied with their everyday life and they found their interests and they're fine with that. But there's also the open synthetic other, right? The open synthetic other is the one that opens the child or the person to society, right? It is a more dynamic version of the synthetic other, which is not only used for the satisfaction, the private satisfaction that the subject has, but is used to be part of society, count somehow. Yeah, let's say for Joey, the mechanical boy, he eventually became an electrician. Yeah, successful electrician. Temple Grandin, a very famous autistic writer and advocate, she became an expert in livestock. Now, all of these were her specific interests. They were her special interests. But at one point, she found out that she can take all of this knowledge and implement it in a way that she would gain a satisfaction, which is not only hers, it also includes other people.
Yeah, so this is the, I think, the crux of it, is that there seems to be, in many treatments for autism, a sort of injunction to get the autistic child or person to comply with the norms of the environment around them. You know, you're supposed to do this, you're supposed, you know, and it's not all that interested in their own kind of like unique idiosyncratic language comprised of signs. It's more interested in kind of like saying, no, you need to come into the realm of the signifier. Enter into this realm, which is sort of would be very similar to asking a person in a wheelchair to run a mile. You know, you don't do that.
That's a very, very beautiful way to put that. Yeah.
Where what you're talking about, and it takes obviously time, patience, probably you make a lot of mistakes along the way, I would imagine too. It's not a simple linear progression, A, B, C, but it's this attempting to enter into the autistic person's, you know, world of signs and engage with them through their language, which is a language of signs. And once you're able to do that, you can kind of progress and help them, in a sense, complexify their language of signs to the point where the gap between their language of signs and our language of signifiers is not so vast.
Yes, and not for the sake of closing the gap. It's not for the sake of making them neurotic. It's for the sake of them having access to the social bond, counting. Because autistic people, they say it, we want love. We want to be loved. We want to matter. Yeah? So again, this is something that they want, that they express. And if that is not expressed, I would not push an autistic person in that direction. Yeah, I think that the level of the dynamic rim, be it the closed synthetic udder or the open synthetic udder is an excellent outcome of a treatment. Yeah, but I wouldn't say that every autistic person has to be a mechanic or an electrician or a professor at the university, right? Some people are fine and quite satisfied building trains at home, right? Mm-hmm. And again, you have to ask the subject, the patient, what do you desire and work with that, right? But the idea is exactly that, the complexification of the synthetic udder via objects, via the use of objects, via specific interests, up to a point where these objects are neglected. And this is the next step and the final step in the linguistic spectrum that I described.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say more about that final step?
Yeah. So the final step is what can be seen as a total reliance on the synthetic other in its linguistic character and neglecting the objects, neglecting these objects that were used. For instance, you were describing the case of Owen, the boy from Radiolab, and the doll that the father used was an object, right? And, you know, some autistic people have a hard time speaking, but when they carry a doll and imagine that it is the doll speaking and not them, they can talk. Yeah, I have some autistics that I work with that express themselves through writing, and we meet in a chat. Yeah, so you have to work with the object. So the computer is a way for them to engage in speech. Yeah, so you have to go through the object. But on the next level, which is called the hollowing out of the rim, is when you clean the rim, you sort of throw away all these objects that were the auxiliary objects, simple and complex, and you're left with your capacities. You're left with your knowledge. You're left with the dynamic functions that they had are now with you, and you don't need the object anymore. It's a little like the Dumbo phenomenon. You know, it doesn't need the feather anymore. It flies without the feather.
It reminds me also a lot of Winnicott and transitional objects, actually.
Hmm. Yes, it's an interesting comparison that I think somebody talks about it already, but I can't remember. Hmm. But yes, I think it could be fruitful to compare the two. This level, and again, interventions on this level are different. Yeah? And I divide them into two types. One is, and this you can see in books like Temple Grandin talks about it. Another very famous autistic writer and advocate called Williams it talks about it in many of her books. And this is an imaginary staging of a loss. Mm. So, for instance, Williams talks about taking these two doubles that she had. She had like these imaginary doubles that she could speak or interact with other people through them. She met them in the mirror. And she stages a funeral where she buries them and makes sure to have no recollection of them. And then she doesn't need them anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's another case of a child that tells the analyst, please record my voice on a tape, take the tape and bury it in order for me to use the voice without the tape being on. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain staging of a loss. And this is one way to hollow out the rim. Mm. The other way, which is even more productive, is somehow incorporating something of the object in the social bond. Yeah. Taking it and giving it to the world in a way, giving it to something which is beyond you, at least. It doesn't need to be the whole world. It can be just something which is not only you. Donna Williams, for instance, talks about publishing her first book. So by writing about her experience, separating it from herself in the form of an object and putting that object in a place which is beyond her control, she reports on a complete change of a dynamic in her life and in the world, in reality. So the last form of intervention that I suggest would be based on these kind of operations, mm-hmm. supporting the subject in an imaginary staging or in its incorporation in the social bond. After that, we have what is called the transparent pole. This is autistic linguistic spectrum, starting with no rim, going through a protective rim, dynamic rim, hollowing out of the rim. The last stage is the transparent pole, which continues forever. Because there's so many autistic people which are not so bothered by this, are not even identified as autistic, and live a very satisfying life without needing any form of therapy or assistance. Nevertheless, they are still autistic, and we have to acknowledge that. That is what is called the transparent pole. You know? Mm-hmm. A lot of people that get a diagnosis at the age of 40 or something like that.
You know? That's really interesting too, because I think you're pointing something out here too, which is that, yeah, that occurs. That there are people that meet that description and they're living lives, they're productive. But you know, I don't know if this will make sense outside of my own head here, but what your work I think helps me to understand is that, you know, there are autistic individuals who do long for connection, who do long to communicate, and to expect them to communicate on my terms, you know, according to the way that I am accustomed to communicating.
Exactly.
You know, it's something that is very easy to do. It's easy to fall into that, to be like, you know, do it my way. And it takes more energy. It takes more effort, I think, to then try to communicate on their terms. Right. And to me, this is so important because, you know, we've been talking about interventions for the past however many minutes here. What I pick up from this, and this applies for autistic people, but for also for anybody, good interventions, I would argue, are predicated on good listening. You have to be able to listen to the person speak. And that, when I say speak, I don't literally mean, you know, with their mouth stating signifiers, right, and stringing them together. Mm-hmm. I mean, the body speaks, the subject speaks in all sorts of unexpected ways. You mentioned, you know, in chat, through text, through drawing, through possibly through dance or some other form of movement. And if we can listen well to the way that these signs, in the case of a person who's autistic, or the signifiers in a neurotic or somebody else like that, if we can listen to that, then we might be able to sort of like calibrate what might be a more appropriate and fruitful intervention in the treatment that we provide.
Yes, and you know, this is something that Lacan said: listen, but don't understand.
That's important.
We can listen, but we don't need to understand. We don't need to fathom from our perspective what is the value of this solution. If it works for the subject, we support it. Mm-hmm. We accentuate it. We bring the person's focus to its facilitative function. But in order to do that, we don't need to understand. Mm-hmm. This is a different form of understanding, right? And I think a humble position from which I think every Lacanian analyst works.
Yeah. As you say that, the way that the idea that I have is that we don't necessarily need to understand, or we certainly don't need to understand completely in order to be with somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, we can be with somebody and they can be with us, and we don't need to have that level of understanding that we're perhaps used to having, you know, with other people. That's okay.
Yes.
You don't need it.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting point. So, anyways, we've been talking for a while here. I think this maybe is a good point to stop. But okay. I still also would say that there's still so much I think we could talk about,
because I agree.
Yeah, there's a lot here. And you know, maybe we can schedule a time to talk about some of these other topics, which I think are really important. But for people who are interested in this, again, I will put in the show notes for this episode of the Inform Podcast a link to where people can purchase your book. Also put some other links in there to, I know you've done interviews other places and I've found some of those, so I'll put some links there.
Thank you.
But let's just say if there's people who are really interested in this and they wanted to get in touch with you, they wanted to find you, how would they go about doing that?
Please just contact me. It's very easy. You go to my website and you write me an email. And I'm very enthusiastic to talk with whomever finds this interesting. Because, it's a book, it's good, it's good that it's out, but it's important for me. Mm-hmm. I feel it's important to think about this and see how we can assist people. Because, it's not a book about, it's a book about theory, but eventually it's about people. It's about people that are suffering today, that are being treated in ways that they don't agree with today in therapy. And I think it's important to open this discussion, and I hope this book will do that. So absolutely, I have the website leonbrenner.com. It's as simple as that. And you can also find me on all the social medias. And please do that if you feel this is interesting to you.
All right. Leon, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Again, I appreciate it so much.
Of course.
And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
I'm sure we will. I'm looking forward.